So I ended up, you know, trying to find a balance between being able to maintain contact with editing fiction while also editing, you know, or also being able to write my own work. But, you know, I do think it taught me a lot too about what, you know, what takes, what would take me out of a story on page one or two. For me, beginnings are the hardest, and like they still are. And so like, I don't know that I certainly haven't mastered anything, but I think it really taught me a lot about editing my own work.
Hi everyone, welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom?
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Sad Me of the Past. I'm Danny Colacci, Executive Director of the Office of Writing and Communication here at the University of Iowa.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the Senior Editor at the Writing University.
And I'm Stephen Lovely, Director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio. And today, we are so excited to have as our guest the writer and editor Megan Cummins. Megan has degrees from the University of Michigan, the University of California, Davis, and Rutgers University, Newark. Her writing has appeared in A Public Space, Guernica, One Teen Story, Ninth Letter, Okie Panky, and elsewhere. Her story collection, If the Body Allows It, was awarded the 2019 Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Fiction and longlisted for the Story Prize and the Penn Bigham Award. From 2014 to 2023, she was the managing editor of the seminal literary magazine A Public Space. Now she's the managing editor of A Public Books, a magazine of arts, ideas, and scholarship. Cummins's debut novel, Atomic Hearts, was published by Ballantine Books in August of this year. Atomic Hearts is a deeply engaging novel about youth, friendship, love, addiction, illness, and the challenges of caretaking. We're drawn immediately into the mind and life of 16-year-old Gertie McMahon, who moves to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to spend the summer with her estranged father, while her mother travels abroad with her new fiancé. Gertie has left her best friend Cindy, another daughter of an addict father, behind in Michigan, and taken with her the secret of a betrayal that haunts her as she adapts to her new life. Cummins's writing is graceful and lucid and, when it needs to be, incredibly vivid. I've had an experience reading this novel that I rarely have reading a novel. When I'm not reading it, I'm thinking about it, about the characters and their predicaments. Cummins manages the near impossible feat of making Gertie's challenges, the turbulence of friendships, the opacity and instability of romantic relationships, the difficulty of balancing accommodation and assertiveness, of determining one's purpose, feel as critical to the reader as they do to Gertie. Was fate a feeling of owning your life or of belonging to it? Atomic Hearts is rich with astute questions and observations like this, so much so that I found myself reconsidering my own youth in their piercing, focused light. Cummins is a skilled architect, too, and interweaves Gertie's youth in Sioux Falls with her life 15 years later when she and her husband take in Gertie's ailing mother. There's also the fantasy novel Teenage Gertie is writing, which Cummins deftly takes us into and out of, and the more complicated novel Gertie will write as an adult. These structural approaches aren't new, they're ancient and venerable, which makes them exponentially more difficult to execute with freshness and originality. Cummins crushes it. The novel's components resonate and converse and hold each other fast, which is what we ultimately need and struggle to provide for each other as humans, the novel suggests, as we continually move in and out of new worlds, toward and away from new people. It's such a pleasure and a privilege to have such a gifted writer and thinker as our guest today. Megan Cummins, welcome to Sad Me of the Past.
Welcome.
Yay. Welcome, Yay. Megan.
Hello.
So Megan, I want to do...
thank you for having me.
I want to do a quick follow-up. So you are also, I didn't put this in the intro, but it's very exciting to me at least. You are also a student at the Iowa Young Writers Studio, the high school program for creative writing. In the summer of 2004, and I looked up. Yeah,
yes.
your counselor was Michelle Falkoff. Your teacher was Thisbe Nissen.
Bisbee.
So
I don't know. Do you have any memories of those times? I mean, unless they were negative, in which case we can just go right past it.
And I can always edit.
I have many, many memories from that time. I think Trish Walsh was still the director at that.
For sure.
Was the director at that point. I mean, it was the most amazing 2 weeks of my youth, I think. I mean, I had never done anything like that. And I learned so much. I'm still in touch with some people from that summer. And I just feel like to be, you know, 16 and to have, or I guess maybe I just turned 17, but to be that age and have your writing taken seriously is just such a gift.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Megan, so it's so interesting to me coming to the studio. You're saying at 17, you were given the opportunity to have your writing taken seriously. We want to go back a little bit further. So what we do in this podcast is we bring wonderfully talented writers like yourself on to kind of help us see how they got to where they are. And through that process, we try to give us a chance, which hopefully we'll do, to hear some writing from youthful you. And then also give a chance to talk about maybe near the end, how that youthful version of yourself would look at who you are and what you became as it relates to writing. So why don't we start all the way back? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in suburban Detroit. So in a town called Northville, which is about 30 minutes outside of Detroit.
And growing up in Detroit, were you always writing? Were you in a home surrounded by people, teachers, friends, whatever it might be, where you were sort of encouraged to read and write? Or was that something you were not doing until a kind of a later age?
I was always encouraged to read. There were always books around our house. My parents subscribed to The New Yorker. So even when I was young, when I wasn't really reading The New Yorker, I was still flipping through it. And I was also just an avid library goer as a kid. So I always had books cycling in and out. And I was a big fantasy reader too as a kid. I think I had read, you know, every book that Tamora Pierce ever wrote. And yeah, so I did actually start trying to write stories when I was in grade school. I think maybe the first one that I wrote in the first or second grade. We were supposed to, you know, tell our own story with Peter Rabbit. So, you know, we were using the Peter Rabbit world, but we were writing our own stories. And it was, of course, later that I sort of realized it was something that wasn't just a school assignment. But I think I was always surrounded by readers and books and magazines. And so I was very lucky to have that.
Always interested in the question of when we realize that we can be a writer. And when we realize that we are a writer, I think it's two different points. But I mean, part of the reason why I started this podcast was because I was thinking about younger me, like you're talking about in elementary school. And it didn't really ever occur to me that being a writer was like a real job. My plan was to be a bus driver, but mostly because I loved my bus driver. At the time, what I like to hear and what I'm hoping that this podcast, part of what it does is that it's a thing that maybe younger writers can listen to and say, you know, you're not born a writer and you're not born already knowing how to write a novel, you know, and that we all sort of take this path through one, discovering that it might be possible, and then two, sort of becoming that writer.
Oh, that's such a good question. And such an interesting thing to think about. I feel like I had a vague awareness, you know, that the books I was holding and that reading and loving when I was a kid, that, you know, someone had taken a lot of time to write those, but it also didn't necessarily feel like it still was some time before I realized that was a job, you know, that was a career. And I think it was maybe around middle school that I think in middle school, at least in the area I grew up, that was when you started having, you know, not one teacher who taught all the subjects, but you had a dedicated English teacher. And I think that's when I realized that this this was something specialized and this was a path. And I had a middle school English teacher who was very encouraging of the writing that I was doing. We had a creative writing unit and I really loved it. And so I think maybe that was the first glimmer of what writing would be for me in the future, or what I wanted it to be for me in the future. Anyway, that it was something that, like, the idea that one day I could write a book first, I think, came into my mind in middle school, even if I had no idea the amount of work it would entail or what kind of writer I would even be. But that, I think that was around the age, around maybe 12 or 13, that I really latched on to that idea as something that I wanted for my future.
So Megan, was your writing something that you did? Was it very private? Did you tell anyone about it? Did you keep it to yourself? Or did you have friends who were also writers and readers and sort of book kids who you sort of hung out with? Or, you know, how did writing play into your, to what extent was it part of your social life? Or was there a community? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was young, I wrote, I was really obsessed with the Titanic when I was young.
Wasn't.
And not just because of the, I know, right? Like, not just, because of the movie. My love for the Titanic predated the film.
Dated Leonardo DiCaprio.
I just want to make that clear. It wasn't just Leo,
You were the first to get there. Yeah.
So I wrote, I would write little stories set on the Titanic that were so silly, one thing I didn't realize was, I could have had the Titanic not sink in these stories.
I was just going to ask.
It always sank.
Yeah, every silly story on the Titanic has a terrible ending. So
I really want to read a book where the Titanic doesn't sink and it's just silly happiness.
Kooky times on the Titanic.
Kooky times.
Yeah. Totally. So, but somehow it's it would be, I was writing about girls my age just running around unsupervised on the Titanic and getting into trouble. But then, of course, they were and then someone told us we had to go to the lifeboat.
Dark turn.
Oh, my God.
About a curfew. Yeah.
Teenage life gets serious real
quick. Yes, right. Yeah. I would show those stories, to my mom. And then I think then sometimes that, a birthday party or something, she'd be like, look what, Megan wrote. But as I got older, writing definitely became more private for me. There was, with the exception maybe of my phase on LiveJournal. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Not LiveJournal. My phase on, I did have that phase, but what I meant to say was my period on fanfiction.net, where I wrote Lord of the Rings fanfiction.
But this is so. We talked to so many writers that's how they started. And I mean, it's becoming, I'm changing my mind on fanfiction.
Yeah,
it's such a great starting point, jumping off point. And so many writers that we've talked to have started there.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe how many writers are just, fan fiction comes up at some point.
LiveJournal.
Yeah, I don't know what LiveJournal is.
LiveJournal was pre-Tumblr, right?
I had both. And I mean, but with fanfiction, fanfiction.net, that was my first experience with sharing my work with someone who wasn't a teacher or someone who wasn't my family. And of course, there was the layer of anonymity to it that, I was behind the screen and no one really knew who I was. My fan fiction did not have that many readers, but I don't think I really thought too much about it at the time, but it did, pressing that publish button felt like a big thing at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that, I think there was a long period where, with the exception of school assignments, I felt like I stopped showing my writing to my mom, but I had this outlet through fan fiction where, I could press that button and people would be able to read it. Yeah. It felt very cool.
Yeah, the dopamine starts to flow.
Yeah, we chase that dopamine. Yep. And you're creating your own world, There's a certain power to it and control, especially around that age where you have very limited agency, preteen and teenage years.
Oh, absolutely.
And then to be able to just have a little bit of control over a world,
So Megan, by the time you were in high school and, you know, you applied to and you accepted and attended the Young Writers Studio, what form had your writing taken by then? Were you writing fantasy?
Yes. Earlier in high school, I was still writing fantasy. I think summer after my freshman year and summer after my sophomore year, I had tried to write, you know, two novels and they were fantasy. And then it was probably junior year that it was the first time I was really writing, or it was the first time I started writing, I guess what you would call realist fiction, you know, it just real people, not fantasy. And it was then that year that I applied to the Iowa Young Writers Studio. So I was there the summer between my junior and senior years in high school. And it did feel like a big shift. And I think it was probably in part because of the books I got exposed to in high school through classes. You know, we started reading, I mean, the usual high school curriculum, To Kill a Mockingbird and Shakespeare and, you know, all that kind of, all those kinds of books. But then, you know, I had a teacher who assigned Barbara Kingsolver and we read, you know, House on Mango Street. And so I just started getting exposed to these books that were different or that were different from what I had been reading. And I think I was really inspired to try to do something like that.
Yeah, I think I
could say, obviously at that age and now, like, you know, I don't know if I could ever do something like that, but to get into that realm, you know. So.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating how many writers talk about the first time that they're exposed to even somewhat contemporary writing. You know, many of us grow up reading, you know, work that is in the canon that feels very far removed maybe from the life or even the world that we're in. And as folks get the opportunity to read more contemporary books, or I know for me, the first time I was able to, like, in high school, meet a living author, it put it all into a focus that I couldn't understand. Even when I would go into, you know, Borders, it just looked like it was a museum of writing, right? Not an active thing. And so it's just really interesting to hear that was something that you experienced by reading some of those somewhat more contemporary books, and also that you noticed your writing shift from sort of that fantasy world into the realist world. Do you remember at that point any difference in the writing? Do you remember finding the writing of fantasy easier or harder, or the realist work to be more difficult? I'm just curious, and again, I know it's a long time ago, but just curious if you have any recollections of that.
Yes, I remember thinking it was harder. I think, and maybe part of it was because I, you know, what I was modeling, what I had taken in as contemporary fiction was nothing I'd ever experienced before. And my teachers were assigning such amazing work. I had a creative writing teacher assign us Ethan Kanan and his short story Bader Zag and Zeralem, which was just, it was just like nothing I'd ever read before. And so I think that was the first time I became aware that what you wrote needed to be good. Yeah. and not that the fantasy that I was reading wasn't good. It was obviously very good, but something about writing fantasy for me when I was 14 felt, maybe it was, I was just so caught up in the world that wasn't our own, that part of it loomed so large that I didn't really, you know, pay as much attention to the elements of fiction, you know, plot or the, you know, what the sentences were. And it was when I started reading more, you know, set in more work set in our real world that there was no distraction of fantasy. It was, and not to say that, you know, the fantasy element of fantasy books is a distraction, but it really is a huge element of it that you get lost in. But when it's someone writing about the real world, that I started to realize then that you needed to present it in a compelling way. you needed to convince a reader to be in that, you know, be in your version of the world rather than their own for a little bit. And so I started writing much less. Like I used to write, when I was writing fantasy as a kid, I would write it over the summer, I would write after school, you know, things like that. But I started writing less because I was intimidated.
Wow.
But I knew I still wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So production went way down.
But, well, it was probably...
which is probably good, you know? So,
well, it was probably much harder. I bet it was much harder. It sounds like what you were doing at that point was really trying to make art, like you were really starting to try to create.
Well, it's intimidating. I remember moving that same sort of movement, and it felt like movement toward the adult world, right? And so it felt...
Yes.
I was a kid, and I wanted to be a grown-up. And writing and reading these books was like a path to get there, but was scary. It was a world of adults and like real working people, you know, and I wasn't your description's perfect because it's like I went from sort of this fantasy world of being a child to trying to enter this quote unquote real world.
Oh, absolutely, Lauren. That I think there was something so aspirational about it that it was like trying on adulthood for the first time. And because at the time, I think I wasn't writing about teenagers. You know, the fantasy work I'd been writing was basically the characters were my age or maybe a couple years older. But for the first time, I was trying to write about adults and I was not an adult. And it was very intimidating. Yeah.
So, Megan, can you sort of situate what you're going to read today sort of in the context of what we've been talking about? Like, is it from around the high school period? Is it from earlier or later? Like, how does it fit in?
Yes. So it is from my senior year in high school. So it was after a year after I was at the Iowa Young Writers Studio, and I was in a creative writing class taught by an incredible teacher named Joe Sislow. He's still at Northville Public Schools. And
hey. Sounds like an incredible school system. Yeah. Creative writing wise.
Amazing.
Anyway.
I mean, it really was. I think I was lucky. And then I'm sure since then they've made changes to the curriculum about, you know, I'm not sure they even have this designated creative writing class anymore, but it was amazing. So anyway, it was in that class, I was introduced to the prose poem, which I had never never heard of before. So, or maybe, you know, actually, I'm sure prose poem came up at the writer studio. But anyway, so this was a prose poem. And for this one, it's like, it's a page single spaced. And so I was really going for it, you know, which at this point,
this
I think
great.
I
was disappointed we weren't going to get to hear, but I was disappointed we weren't going to hear a Titanic story. But now I'm excited about
it. And maybe it's Titanic in a different way.
Yeah. Maybe it's all Titanic.
Yeah. Oh, maybe, you know, it's everything is Titanic, right? So yeah, it was a prose poem that I wrote that I, before coming to do this podcast, because I'm in Michigan, my mom lives here. And I was like, I remember you maybe saving this one poem that has my teacher's notes, like my teacher wrote a note on it. You know, I had turned it in for an assignment. I was like, do you still have that? And this is so mortifying. She's like, yes, I have it framed.
No, shout out to parents.
Way to go. I have so many questions, that I think hopefully the prose poem will illuminate. Because why was this the one that was kept? Why did she frame it? All I want to do is hear this poem.
Did you take it out of the frame, Megan, to read it? Or are you reading it through in the frame?
Let me hold it up. No, I took a photo. I took a photo of it.
Oh,
and so that's what I'm reading off.
Oh, okay.
So,
so Megan, before you read it, can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, do you remember at the time sort of where you used to do your writing? Did you do it at home? Did you do it in your room? Did you do it at school? Like, did you have any rituals or, you know, accoutrements or anything that you sort of like to have around you when you worked? Or Is that making it too complicated?
Oh, no. You know, what I think is interesting is, I think all of my writing on the family computer in the computer room, you know, when I was growing up. And which I, the only reason I find that interesting is because I actually do a lot of writing by hand now, like at, in my current like writing process. I do a mix of like typing and then handwriting, but I didn't really write much by hand as a teenager, which for some reason it feels to me that like that is like a natural way to start writing is doing it by hand.
And you were, it sounds like you were kind of there anyway. I mean, you're reading, you're doing fan fiction, you're doing live journal, like seems like you were kind of, you were on the computer already.
I was on Instant Messenger. I was on the computer. Yes. It was every day, you know, 3 p.m. to right. to 9. I was on the computer. Right.
Your Titanic screensaver. Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, yes. So yeah, so I would write on the computer and, you know, print it out on the printer that chugged along like 1 inch at a time. And yeah, so I mean, it felt, I don't otherwise remember having many rituals or anything like that, but I always wrote like in that same space at home then and now. Like, I don't love it for other people to be in the room. You know, I feel like I need the privacy, and that I'm sure is where I wrote this prose poem, which was a assignment for this class. And so hence, like turning it in and now having the copy with my high school English teacher's notes on it.
Well,
so
let's get to the, maybe you'll be, if you would like, you can read the notes later, but we would love to hear the piece, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Yeah. And so I was looking at it and I was just like, okay, gotta be kind to my,
yes. Oh, of course.
My teenage baby
we're
self.
Tear so. It, of course. Yeah. We're in a safe space.
Okay. Okay. Thank you so much. Okay. The prose poem is called Greek Town. You really shouldn't worry because even though the piano man is getting old, he'll still play you another song tomorrow. Just make sure you bring some extra strength Tylenol. I heard his arthritis is acting up again. So tonight, he'll play us some of his old stuff, you know, the good stuff. And when the bar closes, I'll tell you again that you shouldn't worry, because I know these streets even though you don't, and we still have the music we stole while wandering around the internet. We can listen to Billy Joel some more if you want, but whatever we decide, I think we should stick to stuff we both know so we can sing along. After all, you live in a place where everyone has an iPod, right? It's somewhere out west, I think you said, but I might not remember tomorrow. Write your name down on a napkin or a piece of newspaper that you find on the floor, okay? And maybe a telephone number too. But the second part is up to you. I mean it. It's totally your choice. No pressure, remember? That's what we both said. Anyway, you have those cool iPod headphones that look like earplugs, and their strings remind me of something I'd see feeding liquefied chicken to patients while waiting in a hospital for someone I really don't know all that well. Let's not make that person you, or me either, okay? I know we just met, but can you hear me? Is that okay? So we'll walk along and our shoes will get dirty in the city slush, and I really hope something good comes up next on your shuffle. We'll pass by the bakery and the river, and who knows, maybe that one place in Greektown is still open. If we walk far enough and look forlorn enough, they might let us into Canada out of sympathy, unless they decide we're flight risks, but I think we have a shot. The bridge or the tunnel, it's yours pick since I've been to both. If that doesn't work, we'll go to the river and let the frozen dirt particles in the water lift us up, and we'll get chills when tiny waves reach the bare skin on our necks and arms. Below the surface, the river will freeze your feet and it won't ever clean your shoes. I have this idea that you'll ask me if it's okay to live like this. I know I won't answer right away because hell if I know how we should live, but we both have an inkling that you'll get an answer eventually. 10 years from now, I'll send you a postcard from a dirty part of a different big city. Don't expect a letter because I'll be busy living a less than glamorous life. Anyway, you told me you wouldn't open a letter from someone you didn't know. You were always one up on curiosity. It doesn't really matter if I find the right address or if I even remember your name, because I'll be satisfied when I press the self-sticking stamp down on the flip side of that card with the nightlife of Park Avenue on it. I told you I'd make it there someday. And hear the piercing screech as the flap on the mailbox closes. So even if you don't get it, I think you'll know what it'll read. But I'll tell you anyway, right now, because this is for me, not for you, and it helps me so much to believe when it's something more than a desperate hope kept between shoeboxes in a closet. It'll say, yeah, we can live like this.
Hey,
oh my God.
Right on. Okay, well, so there's so many parts of this that I love, but one, on this podcast, we are huge fans of Billy Joel.
Oh, yeah.
And so as soon as I heard that, I was like, we are locked in.
But when we were at Billy Joel, God. I mean, I had no idea where we went.
We went so many places from there. My first question is, when you wrote this, had you ever been in a bar?
No, I had never been in a bar. I had never even had a drink when I wrote that. So,
so it's like this performative adulthood.
It was totally performative. Yeah. That's what I thought adulthood was going to be like, you know.
But
sad nights after the bar.
And it kind of is.
How right you were. Some of it's definitely true. Yeah.
I mean, Megan, it's so interesting because, yes, there's like that performative aspect, but also just how much of it is a speaker that's presenting, talking to potentially one other person, but also like humanity and sort of saying, I'm going to make it. I'm going to follow this dream. I'm going to end up somewhere doing this thing, and I'm going to send word back to you,
world, wild.
And I'm going to show you that I made it. And like the confidence that I think is maybe masked a little bit by like the uncertainty, but I think there is confidence under there. I just keep coming back to that feeling that this is not only a writer, but you've created a speaker that acts as sort of symbol for potentially yourself and other readers that they can keep doing the thing that is hard. And if they do, they'll be able to sort of send word back from the other side. And you also, just very quickly, I want to say, you also, those images. Oh my God. I was watching you read it.
The chicken one.
Yeah, I was watching you read it, and you have those iPod headphones
right now.
Yes. So I was thinking about
they were so cool back then.
They were super cool.
You know, they were brand new back then, right?
So and just the image of like the feeding of the deconstructed chicken into someone who's sick.
Who you don't know or you won't. I mean, that was an amazing sort of line.
This might be like one of the more perfect pieces for this podcast too, because I don't know who you were writing to at that time, but you reading it out loud, it sounds like you're writing to yourself now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, I was just going to add that, you know, what you said about, you know, the idea that like of writing back to prove that you made it. I mean, at that time, I think I did really want to move to New York, and it was a friend and I had dreams of, you know, going to NYU, ended up not applying for several reasons, but one of them was that I just, like, it was just financially out of reach. And but I still, like, so I think I was writing this in that time where, like, I knew I couldn't go to New York yet, you know, but one day, you know, so.
Yeah, the other thing that was interesting to me, and I think this is true, is that at the very beginning, I was thinking that it was very narrative. Like, I felt you were really sort of telling a story. And then the further it went, just the sort of the more it sort of uncased itself from this sort of story format and just became more meditative and poetic and, you know, a little bit. Yeah, I mean, it was just, I loved the way it sort of moved that way. I don't know. I imagine that, like, you were sort of, as you were writing, you were sort of allowing yourself to let the story come loose and be more free and poetic. I don't know if that's true or not, but it really felt that way. I mean, by the end, and it had this sort of powerful effect of, you know, by the end, it was really intense because I think partly because of that.
Oh, well, I mean, that's so kind. And yeah, I'm trying to remember like how I wrote this. I think I wrote it in one sitting. You know, I think at that point I was very like, it was very kind of stream of like, not stream of conscious, you know, consciousness, but like I was really just letting it flow. And I should also probably give a shout out that there was a Jack's Mannequin song. I was an emo kid for sure, which I'm sure you couldn't tell by that poem, but
right. All the writer kids are emo kids. It
totally.
Seems like,
So like one of my favorite bands was an emo band called Something Corporate. And then the singer started a, you know, another band called Jack's Mannequin. And there was a lyric in that song that was like, yeah, we can live like this. And I did think I was like, so I totally stole that line, you know, for the ending, but you know, it felt like, I think that the idea of like choosing how you live was
Yeah.
And I didn't even know it yet because I was still in high school, but I was about to know it. And those feelings were really churning inside me at the time.
Well, that's like a tool. I mean, I don't know how much I believe in like manifestation but that's a big, you know, word out there right now. And this idea that you can like imagine yourself into a new place. But I think that writers have been doing that for a really long time. I think the act of writing down a picture of your future has this magical component about it that might bring that future into existence. And and I love that idea that even before we really considered that was like a tool that was working in reality, we were writing ourselves into existence, you know?
Oh, yes. I love that. I think I was, and this probably, I mean, I don't remember completely, but I do feel like, you know, I wrote this poem senior year and it did feel a little bit different than even the realist stuff that I had been trying to write, you know, at the writer's studio. And since then, I think it felt, you know, I think sometimes we have those moments in our writing lives where even if we don't know it at the time, we kind of look back and feel like we maybe unlocked a new level. You know, it's where it's like you don't really see yourself getting better, like as a writer, as you're growing up. But then I think sometimes when you look back, you can identify a piece of work that was like a bit of a breakthrough.
Yeah,
for
sure.
It's really interesting.
And
Megan,
I think this was one of them. Yeah,
it's really interesting, Megan, also to think about, you were talking earlier about as you were growing up and starting on your writing journey, writing a lot of fantasy and then moving into this world of kind of realist fiction. And it's interesting in this poem, you are creating a speaker who then is fantasizing about the future, right? And so there's this element of the realist fiction, but it's also even from that narrator's point of view, they're saying, you know, I don't know, maybe it will look like this and we could do this. And maybe what will happen is I'll open that, the terrible screech of the mailbox and put this letter in, but it doesn't feel like the narrator is saying, this is what's happening actively right now. There's like an imaginative existence even for this narrator, which is itself a type of fantasy.
And like that layering too, you have done in Atomic Hearts, right? So in this piece, you're writing about a person writing something, and then in your novel, and then there's a character writing in the novel.
A fantasy novel.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I've been sort of holding back talking about Atomic Hearts just because, yeah, I feel like there's so many sort of parallels between what you just read there and what's happening in Atomic Hearts. Do you want to hold off?
Well, no, I would love, Megan, for you to then walk us maybe up to that point.
Yeah,
it's
a long walk.
You graduate from high school,
yep.
And at some point you said a couple minutes ago, you knew you wanted to be a writer. Is that when you went to college and sort of started to think about your future, were you all in on writing or were you like, actually, I'm going to be a business major? Sorry, that's what I did.
I was all in on writing. No, I was all in on writing. I think from that point, you know, it was probably after going to the Young Writer Studio, which I mean, really, I can't emphasize enough like how big of an impact that program had on me.
Yeah.
And so when I went to Michigan, I chose the residential college, which you know, the teacher, Joe Sislo, whose class I wrote this poem for, had done the RC. And so he like mentioned the RC, which was a small liberal arts track within the, you know, literature, science, and the arts at Michigan. And the creative writing major is through the RC. And so I chose it because they had a creative writing major. I don't remember like when I actually declared the major, but that first semester I took, it wasn't a workshop, but it was like kind of an intro to fiction class where we read a lot of contemporary work, but also turned in a story every 2 weeks or something like that. And really from that moment, I knew like I wanted to major in creative writing. I had been, you know, it was at the Young Writer Studio that I learned what an MFA was. And so even then I felt like I'm going to do the MFA, you know, right after college. And so, yeah, then I think, I mean, I took writing classes every semester all through college and just, you know, I wasn't really submitting my work that much, you know, not until later anyway, but I was writing a lot and it became pretty serious for me pretty quickly that this was what I wanted to do.
Do you remember how your, did your writing evolve at all, do you think, during college? Like, you, did you continue sort of in a realist vein, or you know, did you sort of ever go back to fantasy, or were you pretty much on a straight course toward, you know, the sort of fiction that I feel like, you know, sort of your fiction that's really looking at contemporary life and human beings and relationships and struggles and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, in college, it really continued on a realist vein, you know, and I could definitely see a trajectory of it. From what I remember, I think as the years in college went on, I started paying more attention to plot, I think, which was something that had always been kind of secondary. I was always very focused on writing beautiful sentences, or what I thought were beautiful sentences. And, you know, I feel like my stories were quite, you know, they were very contemplative and not a lot happened necessarily, which is great for, you know, that's a lot of literary fiction, you know, might be able to be described that way. And, you know, I wouldn't say I started writing really loud or dramatic plots or huge plot twists, but I started paying a little bit more attention to maybe some kind of turning point or something in the work or something. I think previously I hadn't really paid too much attention to like the idea that something has to change, you know, or that the status quo has to be disrupted. And I think as I went through the years in college, I certainly didn't like master it, but I started paying more attention to that and like more attention to the shape of a piece. But I still kept writing realist fiction. It wouldn't be until years later that I tried to write a fantasy novel that I kind of abandoned. I never finished it. Maybe I'll go back to it. But yeah, it was, I really sort of committed to realist fiction in college.
And then Megan, post-college, sort of how do we get from graduating from college to putting out, and obviously your wonderful story collection, and then this new novel, sort of how did you realize that next step?
Yeah. So right after college, or my senior year of college, I applied to MFA programs, and I had been introduced in college to Pam Houston's work, and I was just a huge fan. And she, at the time, I don't know if she still is, but at the time she was at UC Davis. And that back then they actually had an MA program in English and creative writing. And so I went to UC Davis. I moved to California, spent 2 years in the program. I feel like I can maybe identify one story I wrote at that time that, you know, it was never published or anything, but I think I kind of identify it as another moment of growth. And then in my last year there, I wrote a story that sort of in different form eventually was published in a public space. So I think, you know, it was at UC Davis that I really started to understand who I was as a writer and what I wanted to write. And then after that, you know, I was working on stories as my thesis. And, you know, there was a several year period after graduating where I wasn't writing as much. I was diagnosed with lupus, and I was, you know, this was before the ACA had been passed, but it hadn't, most of the provisions hadn't taken effect yet. And so I just like had to get a job with health insurance. And like, I really was sort of on a life journey for a few years. And then after, you know, maybe so then like mid-20s, I think I was 26, I decided it was time to like regroup with my writing. And I ended up applying for MFA programs again, you know, because I had done an MA, I was kind of eligible, you know, to do another MFA after that, even though they were essentially the same kind of program. And so that's when I went to Rutgers, New York. And, you know, another 2 years there. And I just was so lucky to have at both programs that time to write. And I think I had a lot of growth, you know, in each time. You know, going to Rutgers, New York also brought me to the New York area. I moved to Brooklyn after I finished the program and did a, you know, it was after that that I started seriously looking for an agent. I had, you know, it took some time, but I actually had the start of what I thought was a story collection, and it's what became, you know, became my first book. So it felt, you know, it was a little bit winding. And I think if you had asked me when I was 18 or 19, like, you know, when are you going to publish your first book? I would have said, oh, well, probably like 25, 24, yeah, you know, so.
I thought the same thing. But Megan, you had a whole career. I mean, you still have a career in publishing, which is one of the things that's always really been kind of astonishing to me, is that you're not only writing, but you were a managing editor, and you're still involved with this incredible literary magazine, A Public Space, which, you know, I just think of as like one of the greatest literary magazines of all time. And so how did you, and then I know you worked at the New Yorker for a little bit. So how did you find your way into publishing, and what sort of role has that played as far as, you know, influencing or affecting your writing life?
Yeah, I think working as an editor has had a big impact on my writing life in a lot of ways. And I had published the story in A Public Space. And, you know, at that time I followed them on social media. And I should add that at that time, Eun Lee was at UC Davis when I was there. And so she introduced me to A Public Space. So I hadn't heard of it. You know, this was in 2011. I wasn't familiar with it until she introduced me to it. And so I had published that story in APS, and then I was living in Newark, and I saw that they were looking for volunteer readers. And, you know, since I was on an academic schedule, I was teaching, but, you know, just kind of one class and like as part of the program. And I, you know, was like, sure, I can come in one afternoon a week to Brooklyn and, you know, and read, you know, the stories submitted. And so that's how I got my start. And I wasn't even, when I did that, I wasn't even thinking like, okay, great, this is my shoe in the door to working in publishing. I was just like, this sounds really cool. And I like want to try it out. And so I was there for, as a reader to start. And then, you know, there was some staff turnover, and I ended up moving into the managing editor position. And, you know, I had been there as a reader. So I had been, you know, I had experienced sort of the office of a literary magazine, but, you know, I was lucky that they were willing to, you know, kind of train me on things. Like I had never used InDesign before. And then, you know, so it started in a very small capacity as a reader. And then in a very kind of lucky way, it grew into my career. You know, I like I said, when I started, I wasn't expecting to have a career in publishing, but it was, you know, and then it was for all the years I was the ME there, it just, I think it gave me such a great sense of all the great writing. I mean, so many amazing writers submit to A Public Space, and just getting to read all, you know, getting to read their work. And, you know, I was lucky enough to acquire some stories and to actually be the editor for some of the stories. I really came to love editing fiction. And I ultimately decided that, you know, when it comes to doing developmental editing and writing, I had a hard time doing both. So if I were editing like a couple stories an issue or something like that, like I could manage that. But when I was working as an editor for the story collection I mentioned, I mean, it was the best experience. It was so, so wonderful. Working with Arinze was just such an honor. I'm such a huge fan of his work. But I did find it like quite consuming, you know, in terms of like having the leftover creative energy to work my own writing. So I ended up, you know, trying to find a balance between being able to maintain contact with editing fiction while also editing, you know, or also being able to write my own work. But, you know, I do think it taught me a lot too about what would take me out of a story on page one or two. You know, for me, beginnings are the hardest, and like they still are. And so like it's, I don't know that I certainly haven't mastered anything, but I think it really taught me a lot about editing my own work. Editing other people's work has taught me a lot about how to approach my own writing more objectively.
That's amazing. I was going to ask you if you guys don't have a follow-up. Yeah, so that's so interesting to me. One thing I'm curious about is when you were struggling to maintain that balance between your own writing and what seems like a really heavy but very engaging workload, like how did you do it? Would you not write for a couple of weeks and then sort of do some writing? Did you have sort of a schedule where you would write
early in the morning or late at night or on the weekends? Or was it something you ever kind of dialed in, or was it just kind of an ongoing effort to kind of keep both things alive?
I am in admiration of the writers who get up at 5:30 in the morning to write. I am sadly not that writer.
Me too. Me too.
I'm a little bit of a sleepy person. I don't know. So it,
I love sleeping so much.
What I would do normally, oh my God, it's the best, right?
It's so great to meet other sleepy writers. Everyone has so much energy.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. I know. I'm like, how do you do it? So, and it's like, I don't have kids or anything, you know? I would mostly write on the weekends. You know, when I first started the APS as Emmy, it was actually a part-time role. So, but then as like the programs grew and they launched a book division and other initiatives, it became full-time. So when it was part-time, I had Fridays in addition to the weekends to write, which was great. When it became full-time, it was, you know, the writing time shrunk a little bit, but I still was pretty much able to write on lucky weeks, both Saturday and Sunday, otherwise just one of the days. And I think luckily for me, even though I don't do very well with writing on weekdays, either before or after work, if I do have a big chunk of time, I can actually stay focused for, you know, 5+ hours, I can write in those big stretches, like, and, you know, feel pretty productive in that time. Obviously, I wish I had more time to write. So, you know, my process right now is pretty much the same. It's if I'm lucky 2 days a week, otherwise one. And, I think the hope for a lot of writers is one day, maybe that could change and I'd have more, you know, I'll have more days, or could either like be part-time at my job and write more, or, you know, one day maybe just be able to write. Who knows? But it's obviously the dream.
I love hearing all the different ways that people write, because, I mean, you're right. There's this fantasy that we wake up in the morning, we write, we drink some tea, we write more. And even if you have that time, like we had that time in the workshop, I wasn't doing that. And I felt I was doing a lot of sleeping.
Yeah.
And I felt like guilty, or like I wasn't being a writer right. I wasn't doing it correctly.
Right.
And I've found in my own life, and I know that you both have as well, that you just get it done the way that you get it done. Danny, you go on Sundays, right?
Yeah, I mean, very similar to Megan. I mean, I've found, as you know, the working life, and also as a publisher and editor, I'm trying to find these balances. And so giving myself Saturday morning, and even if I only write for 3 hours, I mean, that's the biggest piece of time that I have to myself. And I've just learned to do that work then, as opposed to when I was in the workshop, starting my writing at 1 a.m. and then staying up even late. You know, it was a different world. And it's just really great for me to hear other writers that have found that balance, because not everyone, Megan, to your point, not everyone, as much as we all might want, this world in which we can survive and sustain ourselves simply on our writing, many of us have jobs, families, other requirements that take away from that time. And I think helping remind fellow writers that it's not an all or nothing. There are ways for us to find that time. And I'm curious if you're willing to share, Megan, how long did it take you to write Atomic Hearts?
Yeah, so I started Atomic Hearts in 2016. And that was, it actually started as a short story that was published by One Teen Story and edited by the fabulous Patrick Ryan, who's amazing book, Buckeye. It just came out. And it started as a short story. I wrote that story 2016, and I was still working on my collection at the time and a different novel that didn't pan out. And I kept thinking about this story, and I just felt, I think one thing I felt was it felt like it had the fullness, or the characters had the fullness, or it had the potential to be something bigger. And as I was struggling with a novel that wasn't working, I sort of noticed that difference. I think what I came to see was that the novel I was trying to write just was stretched a little too thin because there just wasn't the heft. And so I put that novel down and then decided I was going to turn this, to turn a story, which was called Aerosol. And that was the working title of the book for a long, long time, that I was going to turn it into a novel. And in the first years of writing, I actually thought I was writing a YA novel. And I came to feel that, you know, for my, I mean, much of the book, you know, is, has a teenage narrator and is from a teenage perspective. But I felt like it was dealing with adult themes and adult adult sensibilities. And it just didn't feel like it was working as YA, although it is in, you know, it is in maybe a bit of a crossover space. But I ended up adding that adult frame very late. It was actually, I had queried an agent without it. And one thing we talked about was, or the agent became my agent, Danielle Bukowski. And we were, one of the things we talked about was how it kind of feels, you know, it didn't quite feel adult and it didn't feel YA. And so we were like, well, what, like, what's the solution, you know? And we talked about like adding an adult perspective. And so I took some more time. I fleshed out the adult, you know, adult Gertie's story. And it was then that I felt like the book really clicked. Because even though I, you know, I loved the book as it was in its quasi-YA form, I did feel like there was something missing. And I think part of what was missing was like this maybe kind of proof of life from the future. Mm-hmm. You know, the summer that teenage Gertie goes through is very challenging. And yeah, and I wanted just like, I felt like I needed to open it up a little bit. And the adult perspective did that.
Yeah. And I have to say, Megan, that's so interesting because that adult perspective, when you're looking at Gertie and her husband, you know, with Gertie's mother in the future, I mean, there's just such an incredible resonance and such an interesting sort of conversation between those sections and the teenage summer sections. And they work so well together. And I think that there's so many novels that sort of use that past and present or past and future timeline alternating thing. And I think it's hard to do it really well. And this was just, I just find myself reading just so happy to be in either section and so happy to go back to these sections. And I find they're communicating with each other and saying so much. And then when you begin to introduce the book that young Gertie is writing and then sort of this other book that the adult Gertie is presumably going to write, I think. I'm not finished with the novel yet. Just that kind of complexity and the interplay of all those narratives and parts are just really, really wonderful. And the way the young sort of characters sort of come play a role in her adulthood and the way that future section allows you to go back to sort of a middle section in flashback. And it's just wonderfully complex and well-constructed and pleasure to read, yeah.
A perfect segue into one of our final questions that we always want to ask about that conversation between the past and the present. I'm so glad Ken Stevens' interpretation and what he just said lines up almost perfectly with this question. If you could go back in time to that 17-year-old who wrote that prose poem and show her this book, I mean, what do you think, if you could have that real conversation with yourself, show you this book, what do you think that she would think?
Wow. That is such a good question. I think the 17-year-old me would feel kind of amazed that I had done this. And not, you know, like, not to make it sound like, I feel like that makes me sound really impressed with myself, you know, but
oh no,
but just like the idea that you know, the just even at the time and through college, I, you know, I was writing stories and I was writing short things, and I think if you had showed me the 17-year-old me my story collection, I think I would have been thrilled, and I would have felt like, oh, like my stories, you know, the stories I'm writing, like I kept writing stories and it became something. I think even though I wasn't really thinking about it too much, I think in the back of my mind, there was just this daunting idea that writing a novel is a completely different animal.
For sure.
And I just had never written anything longer at that point, longer than 20 pages, you know, and it really felt like I think I would be just almost relieved, you know, because I think I had this worry for many years, and even into my, you know, like into my 20s and 30s when I was, you know, working on Atomic Hearts, like I think I still had this kind of anxiety that I would never be able to write something that could be sustained over, you know, 300 pages. And so I think there would be a mix of joy and relief that like I could do it. You know, I had a feeling or a hope that I could do it, and it turned out that I could do it.
Amazing.
Before we let you go, final question for you, if you're willing to talk about it, what are you working on now?
Oh, great question. So I, for a while, was actually working on a sequel to Atomic Hearts. But I think that, and maybe one day it will come to be, but I think I realized along the way that I was writing a sequel because I was afraid to write something else.
Wow.
And, you know, I read, I know I'm kind of behind the times here, but I read Lily King's Writers and Lovers recently. And there's a moment in that book where, you know, the narrator is a writer and she is, you know, at the point of starting a new project. And the narrator comments on how, you know, thin and just not real everything feels in the new project. And I think a little, I was continuing the story a little bit because I had that anxiety about like when I start something, it's for so long, it's going to feel flimsy. But that's just the start of a novel. That's just how it is when you start a new book. And so I was clinging to the idea of writing a sequel for up until even like a couple months ago. And then I decided, you know, I'm going to launch this novel. I'm going to like have fun. I'm going to do events. I'm going to just like make it the best it can be. And then I have a couple ideas, you know, a couple ideas for maybe the next novel. You know, I also write so few short stories. Like I'm working on the novel, I really only wrote maybe one or two short stories all those, you know, all those years. And I think I want to write a short story too. So, I know after like publishing a novel, I feel like, you know, I'm holding on to the idea that like, I just want to write and publish one short story.
Yeah.
You know, that really is kind of my goal right now. So
seems like a great goal. Yeah.
Well, Megan, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on Atomic Hearts and all your success.
Thank you so much.
It's been such a pleasure to watch you moving in the spaces that you move in with editing and publishing and writing. And you always have a home here in Iowa City. And congrats again.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Office of Writing and Communication, and the Graduate College. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writing.uiowa.edu/podcasts to see our full list of offerings. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the hosts and guests and do not represent the views or official positions of the University of Iowa or its affiliates. The material presented here is for informational purposes only. The University of Iowa name and marks are used solely to identify the production origin of this podcast. They do not imply the university's endorsement of any views, products, organizations, or services discussed.